You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts. What's involved with a career in sports turf? A few weeks ago in episode 153, I spoke with Marcus Saddington from GLG about careers in sports turf. It was a great chat, but we've only barely begun to scratch the topic's surface. This week, we'll approach sports turf from another angle altogether. David Little is a teacher at TAFE New South Wales, and in this episode, he gives us advice about breaking into the industry, provides technical knowledge of the trade, and he tells us about some of the machinery you can play with in a sports turf career. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, David, we were just talking there before we even get into the main episode. Where are your students coming from? Can you tell me a little bit about where TAFE students who are studying turf are coming from these days?
So the majority of the students that we have coming to campus are predominantly from golf courses and bowling clubs. And we have some people coming from ovals, football fields. We've had students through Wind Stadium before, and various racetracks, race clubs around the district as well.
And you said some staff are also coming from parks and gardens.
Yes, we get some students that come through, they've started parks and gardens or they've completed parks, gardens, or the horticultural course for that instance, and express a bit of a desire to come over to turf. And we see some of those students coming back a year or so later to study turf. So it's interesting.
Mm. So what are the reasons that they're saying, oh, turf's for me, you know, I've tried this other side of horticulture and now turf is what I've decided that my passion is?
I guess some of the guys, well, probably the majority of them have a passion for their home lawns. And when they start to get a little bit of education and training about the horticultural space, turf is not really concentrated on in those particular disciplines like horticulture, parks and gardens. So they want to know a little bit more. And, you know, because they've got that passion about what their home lawn might look like compared to sports turf, they want to come over and see, you know, is that going to be for them? And when it is, they could come through and study and try and aim for the stars.
So these are people who get passionate about lawns. They start learning a little bit, then they fall down a rabbit hole of just learning just how exactly to make it perfect. Then they want to formalize that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So then we see them come in and study at TAFE, and they go through the practicality and the formality of the studies in the course. And with a bit of luck, they could pick up a job in their area or wherever on council. We used to see a lot of council guys come in as well with cricket wickets and ovals and things like that. So there's opportunities for them to progress in quite a few different areas of the industry.
I've also noticed, just anecdotally, speaking with some of the turfies that I've worked with, often there might be an athletic or a sports background too, like maybe as a kid they really love playing cricket or something. Do you find that?
Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of young fellas that come into to study sports turf, and I'll give you a prime example. It's in the sport of lawn bowls. They show a lot of promise on the bowling green as a junior, and some of the larger clubs that have a high competitive outlook like to sign these young guys up to play bowls for the club, and in turn they'll offer them an apprenticeship outside of the greens with the staff.
Right.
So not only do they get a chance to learn all about the surface requirements for that particular sport and discipline, they pick up a job from the club and get a qualification at the back end of that as well.
So, look, a lot of horticulturists do overlook turf management, I think. You know, we go into different niches a lot of the time, and I think turf is crying out for new people to come through. Why do you think it's a mistake for a passionate plant person to overlook turf?
Well, it can be a tricky exercise to maintain turf. You know, there's we've got both warm and cool season types of turf. So you need to be able to just distinguish the differences between the two. But I guess one of the things, or there's quite a few benefits that turf offers to a landscape situation. So it provides a valuable ecosystem for beneficial organisms like bees, soil microbes, things like that. turf also absorbs and transfers a lot of heat from the sun. Some of it can reduce heat and temperatures in certain areas. A manicured turf area actually complements the landscape area. So I think it's quite vital and important to make sure that turf is represented in that landscape space.
Very well said. So what are some of the different settings that a sports turf specialist can work in?
So there's quite a number of them, and the majority of them you will see on TV. So we've got golf courses, obviously, and we've just had the LIV golf tournament down in Adelaide the last weekend past. So there's that sort of setting, which is quite formal and quite high-end. You've got bowling clubs, of course, that provide turf island greens. You've got lawn tennis courts as well. Cricket wickets and ovals. Which has got lawn croquet courts as well. So there's quite a few different settings in the industry that somebody can potentially work at and be qualified in. So there's quite a few disciplines within the turf arena.
Totally. So do you find that it's like the cricket lovers will go and work on the cricket and AFL patches, or is it like really someone who just loves sport or just loves being outside, you know, would it really matter, or what do you find there?
Well, because it's so diverse, and I mean, from my point of view, I've been in the industry 37 years, and so I've been across a few of the different disciplines within the trade. You've got to, first of all, know what the surface requirements are for each individual sport and each individual area. They're not all the same. And I guess it depends on what sort of path you want to tread. If you're competitive in a certain sport discipline, we find a lot of guys actually chase that particular discipline within the job because it just makes it easier for them to translate their knowledge to the surface requirements and the actual sporting requirements, the code requirements. So that particular discipline also. But on the other hand, on the other side of that also, we still get people that transition from, for example, bowls to golf for something a bit different and vice versa. So we've had a lot of bowling green keepers transfer over to cricket. So different discipline, different area of the trade, still similar type practices. But there's a few details there that are slightly different, and that's basically what probably would attract people to make the change.
Yeah, so I can imagine that would be a big transition from a bowling green to a golf green, like completely different sizes.
Well, it can be vice versa as well, because the majority of the surfaces in a golf course are of cool season grass varieties. So they have the growing seasons are different. And with the warm season grasses that are required on bowling greens, they require a little bit more attention, a little bit more detail in the way that they need to be renovated. And the surface requirements for the particular sport are quite different as well. So, yeah, it can be a process to transition from one to the other.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I've had a few students actually leave golf and go to bowls. And they've found it a little bit more difficult than they expected. Just because of the playing requirements, the timing of schedules, and the actual attention to detail you need to provide on those particular areas as opposed to golf. Like a lot of ride-on type machinery with golf, whereas with bowls, it's all walk behind, quite detailed. Not to say that taking anything away from golf, I love looking after golf greens, bent grass, it's magnificent. And I've been on warm season grass basically the majority of my career, but I just find at that next level you need to go to adapt to a different type of sport and those requirements.
Yeah, I can see that. So how does one break into this sector? Like, how does somebody become a turfie? Like, what are the first steps? Is it always an apprenticeship, or are there other pathways?
Well, I got into this industry when I was 16 in year 10 in high school, way back in the 80s. And I did work experience for a week with school at the local bowl club. So there's that avenue for school kids. And then I guess to progress on from that, you're chasing down traineeships, apprenticeships, things like that. And, you know, with various institutions, whether that be with local councils, with the sporting clubs, sporting clubs, golf courses, wherever it may be, that's the normal pathway into the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you can progress on from there if you make it and you successfully complete the course. You can go on to do, you know, higher levels of education in the industry as well.
So can you walk us through a few of those pathways in terms of education? Like, is it just Cert 2, Cert 3? Like, where can people go after they've sort of been entry level? Like, what's that pathway there?
So the students have to complete the Certificate 3 in Sports Turf Management. That's the prerequisite to move on to anything higher. Right. The next stage from there is a diploma in Sports Turf Management. Mm-hmm. That's an extra 2 years, I believe, over and above the trade qualification. And if you wanted to go a little further, you can actually progress through to university as well and do your master's in agriculture based on to like specializing in turf. So there's quite a few different avenues to go and a few different levels to actually achieve for as well.
Mm-hmm. So what if someone wanted to be in management? Would a Cert 3 be enough, do you think, or would they really need a diploma?
Well, I guess it's actually in the name of our trade, sports turf management. When we qualify as a sports turf manager after TAFE and we do our four-year apprenticeship, if we're lucky enough to pick up a head greenkeeper's job or a course superintendent's position, we basically become managers of not only just the venue but our staff as well. Mm-hmm. And volunteers will come in with various events. You're basically managing the entire process. So, I mean, your managerial type subjects in the diploma will certainly help with that over and above. But yeah. I think the majority of the guys that haven't had their diploma studies completed make the transition quite easily, and they're able to manage everything that's on their plate, given the fact that they have a yearly schedule that they need to stick to as well.
Mm-hmm. So you can learn enough on the tools, being a team leader of a smaller crew, and with your Cert 3, that's enough to get you up into one of those upper levels within a company.
Yeah, sure. Yep, absolutely.
So what are some of the like key responsibilities and tasks of just a general entry level or experienced turf, sports turf specialist working on the tools? And what are some of the skills and knowledge that's required to succeed in these types of roles?
Okay, so I guess one of the most important responsibilities is to actually provide healthy turf surfaces for a particular sporting arena or a sports turf surface, as we mentioned before, bowls or golf. There's a lot of routine maintenance that need to go into these particular areas. Providing consistent and even surfaces as well, which is a key to a lot of sports. Regardless of whether they're being quite physical or not so physical.
Hmm.
We need to be responsible for maintaining and use all of the equipment and machinery that is under our care. That's quite a strict routine that needs to be adhered to. We've also got a lot of things like regular cultural practices that are actually key to preparing and maintaining these areas. So regular mowing, regular fertilization, correct irrigation practices, correct weed, pest, and disease identification, and controls of those. So there's quite a lot in it.
Quite a lot in it.
Yeah, it's a lot more than people think. you know, I used to get things from members like, I don't know much about grass, but I've grown a lot of tomatoes and veggies in my backyard. And, you know, I don't see why you should do this and you should do that. You know?
Oh, yeah.
and I think, well, you try cutting your tomato vines at 2.5 millimeters in height and see what sort of product you get, right? And you certainly don't have 200 members a week or a day trampling over the top of you. So, you know, there's quite a few things that you need to take into account that are key to a successful outcome, really.
And I reckon that's probably going back to what we were saying earlier about why people are getting into the industry in the first place. Like, they actually do fall down that rabbit hole of learning all this stuff, and then suddenly it's like, oh, wow, I can just keep going deeper and deeper, and there's just so much more to it. And then one day, you know, they're at Marvel Stadium sort of rolling the turf there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I say, we've had students come in that have just been at a second or third tier golf course up in the Highlands. Their yearly budgets are very small. And I sort of try and get our guys out and about around the state to various venues. And we like to go sort of high end. So we've been up to Royal Sydney Golf a few times before. We've been to ANZ Stadium, Bankwest, the New South Wales Golf Course, the Sydney Cricket Ground we've even visited. The guys can actually aim for something bigger and better than where they actually are. And they can see where the pathway will lead, yeah? So there's something quite attractive about that.
So what difference do you think that makes for your students? Like thinking forward in their whole career, people might underestimate just how much this experience will add to their life, don't you think?
Oh, we've always said it's sort of a known thing in the industry that it's not an actual job. It's a way of life. You actually live it because you're looking after a living thing. And it doesn't stop. It's always changing. Weather changes, seasonal demands change, the climate has changed in regard to the way the seasons have operated. And so it's never ending and it's always evolving. So, you know, even at my part of my stage of my career, there's still things that I see on a day-to-day basis and think, wow, I didn't realize that. Or you know, there's something that's always hitting you in the face to make you change your mind about something or have a go at another technique or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Look, at this point, anyone listening right now has probably graduated beyond this question, but I wanted to ask you this question because I think it really taps into a certain kind of a mindset. And it's, so how hard can it really be? Surely turf management is just mowing, fertilizing, and irrigating, right?
Yeah, sure. That's what the average person out there probably seems to think. But, you know, we've discussed a few points earlier. There's a lot more to it than that. There's a lot involved in preparation for these particular areas. You know, most of the turf managers that I know and I converse with regularly have a yearly maintenance program. So they're working month to month, season to season, year to year. And they're trying to plan the maintenance of these areas around tournament schedules, club championships, visitations from other places. So there's quite a lot of planning that goes into it. There's a lot of training involved behind in the background as well that you need to be mindful of and that you need to succeed at as well. So things like diagnosing nutritional deficiencies in turf, it's quite hard. You being horticultural background, you'd probably be aware of how easily it is to see a nutritional deficiency in, say, a lemon tree or something like that with bigger leaves. You try and look at nutritional deficiencies in turf when you look at some of the leaf surface area is less than 2 millimeters wide and you're basically on your hands and knees trying to pull the nap of the grass apart to see if it's the older leaves or the newer leaves that are being affected or, you know, it's basically an overall appearance. So there's quite a lot more in it than just that. We concentrate on a hell of a lot of soil chemistry as well, which a lot of other disciplines don't. Soil chemistry is basically our springboard to success, I guess you might want to say. So we delve into soil chemistry quite heavily. And you need to know what roles and what benefit that plays in healthy plants at the end of the day. So we touched on this before as well, knowing the differences between warm and cool season grass types because they perform differently and they allow you to do different things as well. So you know, if people just think that it's, you know, just sitting on a roller or walking behind a mower, it's certainly not that. There's a lot more to it than that.
No. Look, we've touched on cool and warm season grasses, C3 and C4 grasses. Before we move on to the next point, can you please define those two terms for us and explain why that matters?
So with obviously warm season grasses, cool season grasses, they have a different temperature zone that they will, or temperature range that they will thrive in and that grow at their optimum. So the cooler season grasses, I think the temperature range is around 18 to 23 degrees at their optimum. And the warm season grasses are obviously a little higher than that, 23 up to 30-odd degrees is their optimum temperature range. And also, with the cooler season grasses, they have a two-stage sort of growth cycle, whereas the warm season only have one. And the warm season grasses go into dormancy in the cooler months of the year as well, where the cool season grasses don't go dormant like that. So it's quite a significant difference, especially in appearance, for those people out there that have seen a bowling green in the middle of winter. I've had many comments thrown at me before, like, oh, they're not bowling greens, they're bowling browns, because they look brown. They've gone dormant, right? So, yeah, that's one of the things that always gets thrown at us during the winter months.
What else gets thrown at you?
Oh, look, we've had plenty. we're just glorified gardeners or, quite a few things. And I'd have to sit down and think about probably some of the worst, but I guess basically it's because the industry and the trade is a little bit misunderstood, you know, in regard to how difficult it is to be successful in it.
And what about the rewards of when you are successful in it? Like, what is it like living the lifestyle of someone who's, you know, maintaining the top of the top?
Well, I've prepared areas for state and district events and things like that, and there's nothing more rewarding than planning for an event months in advance. And when the event is a success, and off the back of that, your staff reap rewards as well. There's a real sense of achievement, and there's a sense of prestige for the club as well to host those events. So it sits well on your resume, and it's nice to be involved in something a little bit more high end as well. So certainly a lot of satisfaction in that particular part of the job.
Yeah,
even coming through a really difficult renovation period, and there's, you know, the weather or can throw curveballs at you all the time in regard to cold nights. You only need the temperature to sort of drop a few degrees overnight in certain times of the year for the grass to stop growing. And if you're in the middle of renovation program and it's not doing what you expect it to do, you've got to adapt and you've got to overcome those issues and continue on with what you know and just be patient, I guess. So there's a lot of things when you go through some adversity like that, there's a lot of rewarding aspects to that.
Yeah, and I think as well, you know, as Australians, we love our sport, and sure, to be a part of something that, you know, you've watched on telly maybe since you were a kid or something, like maybe you're a big AFL fan and that's what you used to do with your family, was watch AFL or go to the games. To actually be a part of doing that in your day-to-day job, I think there's just something special about that.
Yeah, 100%. Like some of this, when the students come in to see us for those 3 years, I mentioned before that I like to take them out to the higher-end venues, the more elite-type areas for them to have a look at. Some of those particular arenas or venues offer us the chance to be involved in a volunteer program for 3 or 4 days to prepare those areas for, let's say, the NRL Grand Final, State of Origin. We get a chance to become volunteers on the higher-end golf courses during, let's say, the Australian Open or the New South Wales Open that's been on through Sydney many times. So the guys get a chance to actually become volunteers for those sporting events and have that on their resume as well. And they know what's involved then. It's a little bit different to what they do at work, but because it's at a higher end sort of venue, it adds a little bit more prestige. And it's something that they, as I say, they can put on their resume and they'll never forget that experience either.
Totally. Okay, so what about like normal everyday parks and gardens workers or, you know, just landscapers and just general maintenance gardeners? Like, what can we learn from turfies? What are some of the principles that you guys know that we aren't focusing on?
I guess the fineness and the finer detail of actually maintaining a fine turf area, a sports turf area. So, you know, the heights of cut, the types of machinery that we use as compared to parks and gardens or hort. So we're using high-end cylinder mowers you know, that are latest in technology. They give us a totally different appearance and a different outlook. The cut quality is totally different as compared to like the rotary style mowers. So we use a lot of different things like that. And we're focusing on the fineness and the detail and that consistency of that one particular area as opposed to a broad thing like a full landscape situation. So the devil is in the detail of that little patch of grass.
Right. Okay. So we're being too relaxed. We're focusing on the hedging and the, you know, the pruning and all that sort of stuff. And we're letting our, you know, maybe it's just one patch off in the corner, but when a turfy steps up, they notice it.
And, you know, we've mentioned things like climate, and I'm not talking about climate change. I'm just talking about different climates. So, being Queensland, Western Sydney, far south coast of New South Wales, the climate's different. The weather patterns are slightly different. If you're on the coast or in the highlands, your turf will perform differently. And, you know, there's other techniques that we can use to beautify those areas if they're not performing as we expect. And when I'm talking about that, I'm thinking about oversowing grass areas with a different type of grass. So we're using like a ryegrass oversowed on a warm season area that may have gone dormant. And a prime example of that is you look at all the NRL stadiums and venues that are on TV at the moment. My students have just helped out in a renovation process at Wynn Stadium in Wollongong, where they scarified the couch grass that's starting to go into dormancy, and we've oversown the entire field with a particular species of ryegrass, and that will just provide winter-long deep green colour when the guys are mowing it and preparing it for a football game. You can see the nice stripes in it because the leaf is glossy and it's green, dark green in colour. So you've got all those options as well.
Yeah. So that actually brings us on to our next question really nicely. So what are some of the best grass varieties that make for good sports turf around the country?
Okay. So I guess if we sort of break it down sport by sport, we've got a lot of bent grass varieties in golf. Most of the golf greens are a bent grass variety. So, and they just lend themselves to have all year round colour, nice, consistent, even surfaces. Some of the new species are quite disease and insect sort of attack free, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So they're aggressive growers, so they're attractive to the eye. They're easy to look after, provided the right thing is done. Other areas around the golf course, they're using kaikuyu, a lot of fescues as well. And there's some really nice new zoysia species out on the market at the moment that are slow growing, don't require a lot of water, but they have a nice fine grass, like leaf blade as well. So they look nice. Looking at the bowls, so you've got your couch varieties that are pretty much standard these days. Tiff Dwarf is one of the cultivars that's probably the most common. Just because it's nice and fine, it grows very tightly. You can cut it quite low at around 2.5 to 2 mil. So provides a really nice firm surface for the bowlers. And then you've got racetracks, football ovals, they're couch and mixture of couch kaikuyu as well. And we've mentioned before, like there's some oversowing profile techniques to be done with ryegrass on some of those as well. So they're probably the most common species that are used in the industry at the moment.
So when we're talking about oversowing, we're talking about throwing some of those winter grass seeds down so that we can get some of that colour and vibrancy back in when the warm season grasses aren't at their best.
That's right. And it's a simple process. The germination rates, I think between 7 to 21 days, depending on the species of ryegrass you put out. You should get a strike, depending on your species, within 5 to 7 days. And it's an extended germination process after that. And it's just a matter of doing what you need to do to make it right. And a really simple process to eliminate that ryegrass at the end of the season, so when the couch grass comes out of dormancy and you want that solid base to maybe if you've got a transition to another sport really quickly, so winter to summer sport. So it's quite easy to get rid of that ryegrass with a chemical application and then concentrate back on the warm season again.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we touched on a little bit earlier, you mentioned that we're selecting, you know, disease-resistant varieties. This is a great genetic method within an integrated pest management strategy.
Sure.
What are some of the common pests and diseases that can affect sports turf? And other than choosing good varieties, what can we do to remediate those issues and prevent them from happening in the first place even?
Well, there's quite a few pests and diseases that are quite common in the turf industry. And it's funny because if you leave something go, you know what weeds are like. They'll grow wherever they can. And probably better than anything you're actually trying to promote.
Yeah.
So they're always difficult to control. But a lot of common pests that we deal with in the sports turf industry, we've got sod webworm and the army worms in some of the longer grasses. In the finer grasses, we've got things like Argentine stem weevil, kitch mite, billbug. There's an African black beetle. There's quite a few different types of pests that can cause us all sorts of headaches. There's even naturally occurring nematodes in the soil that can do damage, even though some of them are beneficial. And, you know, we can talk about control methods, I guess.
It's probably a whole other episode, really.
Yeah, but it is.
It's good to touch on it.
Yeah, and even with the diseases. So we get a lot of leaf spot type diseases, fusariums, brown patch, black and white helmet. Pythiums are real common wood in the cool season grass space. When they hit very hard. And if you're not on your game and don't have preventative measures in place, I've seen golf courses or half of a golf course chewed out in a couple of days with some of those things, you know, so they can be quite ravenous and detrimental. So, I mean, off the back of that, you know, I think you mentioned something about how do we go about controlling some of these. We normally put a yearly program in place in regard to you mentioned IPM before. Correct diagnosis is key to each and all of these. And then off the back of that, you need to make sure that your control process is measured and calculated, and it's done correctly. I mean, some of the things that we use in the industry can be detrimental to off target. So we need to be mindful about what we use, how we use it, and be targeted and measured in our approach as well. So as I said, generally there's a preventative process or a program in place for nearly each and all of these things that I mentioned. And it's seasonal as well, mostly as well, right? So they only do damage to you in certain times in the year. So you can program and plan for that. And off the back of that, if your programming or planning gets compromised in any way, there's always a curative program that you can, or curative actions that you can take when necessary. So, you know, we've got a fairly big arsenal to fall back on if we have some sort of issue with pest and disease.
So sometimes, you know, plants succumb to health issues that actually aren't due to a pest or disease. We call these abiotic stresses. Let's talk about weather. Like, on either end of the spectrum, what's going on with weather? What are some of the best practices around mitigating abiotic stresses due to weather?
We're at the hands of the gods, really, aren't we?
And unfortunately.
You know, like the best laid plans usually are ruined by weather. So, you know, there's been numerous occasions where I mentioned before planning for a particular tournament that could be a month or two away, and the weather patterns have been fantastic all the way through. And the week before, the day before, you get 25 millimeters of rain. So your preparation plans for the actual day of the tournament are thrown into chaos. The surface conditions will be different as well. So the pace of let's talk about a bowling ground, for example, the pace of the bowling ground will be a lot slower when the ground is wet, when the surface is wet. So, yeah, weather plays a huge part. I guess with technology nowadays too, as I said before, our machinery and equipment is far better than it used to be. So we don't cause as much compaction with the machinery that we use in bad weather events. So when the surface is wet. But we also have the advantage now of all the new weather apps, things like that we can actually forecast in advance what we might need to do in case something is on the horizon. So there's a few things, a few strings in our bow that we could use to try and get through that. And just, I guess, at the end of the day, you've just got to try and do the best you can, because the players and the public that might be sitting there watching this particular event need to see everything at its best. So, and as you said, it's not always the case, but you've just got to grin and bear it and get through it the best you can and provide the best surface you possibly can for the players and for the spectators.
Yeah, well said. You just got to get through it. You got to use your best practices. And I suppose that's why you got to go to TAFE in the first place, right?
100%. Because we like to try and teach the 1%ers. And, you know, there's a lot of technicality that we need to get through. And at TAFE, we provide that technical aspect that the students need to transfer over to the practical aspect at work. So they get the benefit of being at work for so many days a month. They come to see us for a few days a month, and we provide that technicality to the practicality. And then, and with their hands-on experience, they're able to formulate plans and programs that best suit what's required for their area.
Look, we've touched on some of the machinery a couple of times. Like, what sort of machinery will people have the opportunity to work with in a turf career that they wouldn't have the opportunity to work in, you know, say, any other horticulture sector?
So I guess with the renovation machinery, so we've got some of the new technology in regard to aeration is really high end. So I don't want to name drop, but I will, because I happen to be a fan of this particular brand, and we've got brand new Toro equipment at TAFE at the moment. So the aeration machinery from Toro is magnificent, nice and quiet, and the operational speeds are just really nice and smooth and even. They provide varied depths of aeration. So those sorts of machinery that most other facets or areas of hull won't use, even with scarification and top dressing. So we have, you know, automatic top dressers now, trail behind top dressers as well, as opposed to just spreading it by hand, soil by hand back in the day. So there's a lot of things like that. The larger ride-on type machinery, so the 5 and 7 gang cylinder mowers that we use on larger fairways and golf courses, the Parks and Gardens guys probably wouldn't have the opportunity to use something as high-end as that. And even down to a walk-behind cylinder mower, like we have a new Toro walk-behind at the TAFE campus now, and it's probably the best mower I've ever walked behind. And I've been behind quite a few.
Yeah. Well, that was really the machine that's kind of almost pulling me in the direction of turf, is the rollers, because they're just so cool. And the finish you get off them is astounding. Like, we just don't get that with our regular mulch mowing plugs.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was an apprentice, I left school a little bit earlier than some of my friends, and they used to walk through the school, the bowling club, to get to school. And I'd be sitting on a roller, rolling greens, preparing for play in the morning. And everyone would just go, that's all you do all day, sit down on that roller thing. But that's not what we're doing. There's a means to an end. And, you know, like, you've got cutting, rolling, preparing as part of the actual process. So, yeah, they're a pretty cool little thing to ride. But, you know, once you've been on them for a long time, it's nice to have a change.
Yeah, right. And I suppose that's the career progression, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, there's different types of rollers on the market too now. So, you know, they're not just slow push rollers anymore. A lot of them are a lot larger. They're a lot lighter. Some of them are more compact. So, like, golf courses have gone into rolling greens the last sort of 10 or 15 years that they've never done before. And so the rollers are portable. They need to be towable, so they can tow them from green to green behind a little buggy. So just that sort of technology is really, it's groundbreaking as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Toro have a fairly large ride-on, massive deck size.
Yeah.
With the rollers.
Yes, they have the range that they have in that particular space. So larger, broad acre type mowing. Huge,
with the rollers.
Yeah, huge technology. And, you know, as you say, they've got five and seven different deck cutting decks on them. They're all hydraulically operated. So when they're parked in their space, they're compact. But when you get them out in the field and you lower everything down to get to use them, they could cut a really big area in a short period of time.
All right. So let's move on now from petrol machinery. By the way, Toro, you should definitely sponsor this podcast. I've got a lot more than I could love to talk about Toro machinery because they are very good. But let's move on now to sustainability and an environmental responsibility. Is that something that's being thought about a lot within the turf industry these days?
Yeah, definitely. The environmental issue is quite sensitive in this day and age. And when we go about our job, we've got to do things in the right manner. There's a process that we need to follow. Legislative requirements, you might want to say. And it's all based around looking after the environment, because some of the chemicals that we used to use back in the day that are thankfully off the market now were harmful, and not just to the environment, to us as users. So we're always mindful about how we go about the process, what the impacts may be of off-target. And when I mean off-target, I'm talking about we're concentrating on one particular area, and if we happen to have an incident, the area we don't want affected is what we call the off-target. So we're always mindful about that situation. We go through an environmental risk assessment with most of the things that we do as well. And we've got control measures that we need to put in place to protect the environment. Like most of the golf courses that we've experienced in this country have their own water supplies. And the last thing you want to be doing is contaminating that water supply. There's a flow-on effect from that, storm water as well, that can end up somewhere else and doing all sorts of damage. So, yeah, sure, it's a big issue. And the way technology's progressed, as I mentioned chemicals before, even with nutrition and fertilizers nowadays, there's a real big focus on using a lot of liquid foliar applications now, as opposed to soil-drenched type applications. So those liquids and foliars are taken in by the plant really quickly. They're in a readily available form of nutrition, so the plant doesn't need to break them down before they're used. And you only put out what's required. You don't need to go out with those old big dumps of, dry feed that the old greenkeepers used to use and, have half of it wash away in a rain event. So, there's a lot of things that have gone on, a lot of new techniques and technology that's come along that's made us a lot more mindful about how we treat the environment with what we do.
I think it's really important to touch on this because I think so many people are still in the view that, turf is this backwards industry. And look, there's always going to have to be sacrifices when we're weighing up our values, but I actually really value the leisure and the fun and the cultural benefits that sports turf can bring that nothing else can bring us.
For sure. I mean, all you've got to do on your weekends, when you drive through a park or through the neighbourhood, the parks are full of families and people enjoying the grass, the facilities. It's become a really big thing this day and age. If you look at some of the subdivisions and the areas that are quite new around a particular local area, the block sizes for houses have gotten a lot smaller. So the green space that people have available at home is a lot smaller. So these big green spaces outside have become the weekend warrior's playground, I guess you might want to say. Mm-hmm. So, it provides a lot of benefit.
Yeah, we don't all have backyards and, I love kicking around a footy. And having a park down the road from me, just a sports turf oval, it was at your local level, so it had a lot of weeds through it and everything. But we didn't care. We just wanted to kick a footy around and tackle each other and, have a bit of a scruffle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, from that, the younger kids might get interested in playing football or soccer or hockey or cricket. So it might venture them into investigating that sport a little more. So then the parents get involved, and I've done it with my kids. You become volunteers at the local football or soccer club, And then on weekends, you end up marking out fields and running the canteen and cooking barbecues. So you've got that community aspect of what turf brings, of what sports turf brings as well.
And not to mention the biodiversity aspect as well.
100%. So, you know, grass creates that little micro environment as well. You know, it's funny, a lot of people, we mentioned this before about, you know, people think turf is a bad thing and we shouldn't do this and we shouldn't do that. But in actual fact, if you, and this is Googleable, by the way, if somebody wants to fact check, a hectare of grass actually provides more oxygen and takes in more CO2 than a hectare of trees. So you can see the grass is actually quite helpful in biodiversity.
Yeah, and that carbon can go down into the soil. Some of it stays there for a while, and some of it feeds all of the little critters that are going to live, breathe, eat each other, do their thing, sustain biodiversity, feed the birds, blah, 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 all that good stuff that we really want that we're trying to plant these biodiversity gardens for, we can actually get from turf as well. So, yes, there's not going to be as many pollinators because there's no pollen. There is actually pollen in grass that insects eat, but we're not talking about, you know, they're not going to get a whole lot of nectar out of a grass turf, but there's still biodiversity there.
Yeah, 100%. Well, like one of the renovational practices that we go through is dethatching of grass, of turf surfaces in most summer. If you provide a healthy soil profile, the soil chemistry is nice. You've got a lot of microorganism activity in the soil. They turn over nutrients, which feed the plants to grow quicker and more healthier. And when the microorganisms start to break down all this, they actually break down the mat and thatch as well. So they're producing a natural food source for plants and for turf as well. So there's something in it for all of us.
That's it. Yeah, sorry to get up my high horse. My listeners
That's
probably
all right.
are used to me by now trying to defend turf, but because of the circles I'm in on Twitter and stuff, I just see a lot of turf hate, and I always try to rush behind turf and try to defend it.
Yeah, well, I defend it all the time as well. It's been my livelihood, and actually the industry's given me everything I have. So, and I'm fortunate enough to be in the teaching space now that I give back to the industry, and you know, it's not all bad. It's not all doom and gloom, that's for sure.
No. So what about health and safety now? Now I'd like to move on to like what are some of the nuts and bolts aspects of being in the turf industry. Tell me about like what safety procedures are in place to keep people, you know, make sure people can get home every afternoon.
So we do an extensive WHS unit in the first year of the guy studies. It concentrates a lot on legislative requirements, risk assessments, job safety analysis, and I take the guys out. We do a lot of site inspections. They do a lot of documentation. They've got to go through that process. Safe operating systems, safe systems of work. There's all those sorts of things involved. And I always say to my guys, you turn up to work with two arms, two legs, 10 fingers, 10 toes, hopefully, and you want to go home with the same, right? So the safety process, WHS process, is quite extensive, and it's not getting any smaller. If anything, it's getting larger, and it's evolved into this big beast of a thing. I remember many years ago, there was no such thing as risk assessments. You just went out and you were taught how to do something and went and rolled with it. And it's not until you get into the managerial type status that you have to start thinking about other people besides yourself. And you need to make sure everybody gets home, you're safe at work. So, yeah, it's an extensive process and all the paperwork to get done. But you know what? I guess at the end of the day, if it keeps everybody safe and they're able to do what they need to do for a successful outcome, I mean, I'm all for it.
That's it. I know that there's always this you have to balance up productivity with safety, and it's just an eternal way. Is there a better way to do things safely that's more efficient? It doesn't mean that we need to just sacrifice efficiency altogether. It just means that we just need to think of a better way to do it safely.
Yeah, that's correct. Like I mentioned earlier, even just the technology in advancement in chemicals and fertilizers that are available now compared to what was available before. You know, we're no longer seeing S7, Schedule 7 type chemicals on the market. And we can find biological type methods and processes that we can use that are far more safer and still do the same job. It might take a little longer for that process to evolve, but you know, if it makes it safer and easier to use and you're still getting the same result, why not?
Yeah. We're not talking about going back to hand weeding. We're just innovating a new product.
Yeah, that's right. Well, even like some of the old fungicides that my old bosses used to use, like, you know, they're just, you could see and smell that they were dangerous. And none of that was sort of talked about back then. And it's not until you get a little older and a little bit more experienced to know what the dangers of those chemicals are and what's in them that makes you sit back and go, wow, had I have known, maybe I might have been a little bit more careful, or I should have maybe looked at a different option or whatever. But, you know, as I said earlier, thankfully, those harsher type chemicals are no longer available on the market. No, mercury-based and arsenic-based, and they're just dangerous. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, they're not on the market anymore.
Yeah, I'm going to get out of my depth if I start talking about chemicals too much because, other than to say I think it's best that we leave them as a last resort, and this is what I learned in TAFE, is that there are a lot of things we can do before we reach for that chemical bucket.
100%. And, you know, we always like to talk about the promotion of healthy growth and successful cultural practices. If you have those on point and your soil chemistry is nice, and where it needs to be within range, you know, with different values, there's a less need to resort to those chemical processes, you would think, you would hope.
Totally. Because there are knock-on consequences, and I'm not going to harp on and on about the mycorrhizae and everything. Everyone's already heard that to death, so let's just keep going.
All right, done.
So what are some of the key trends that are likely to impact job opportunities in this industry in the years ahead, do you reckon, Dave?
Well, there's over the last few years, I'd probably say the last 10 or 15, money's gotten harder to come by. So you see a premature closing of some of the smaller clubs, you know, the smaller community engaged clubs. That's been of detriment. You know, because people lose their jobs, the clubs close down. They don't ever reopen. The membership has to move on to somewhere else, and they normally get enveloped by an entity that's even larger. So, you know, there's that side of things. That's probably the biggest thing I've seen in the industry in the last sort of 15 or so years, just the way that the rate that some of the bowling clubs especially have closed down. So, you know, as I was saying, there's a flow-on effect, and if venues like that close, staff lose their jobs, and they're certainly not offering anything in the future either. So that's probably one of the biggest things I think I've seen.
So I wonder if that's due to a change in demand for the sports that people are going for. Like, is that because people are gaming more? Is it because they're moving to like AFL? Is it because the demographic that used to play that sport is aging now? Like, what do you think's going on there?
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of all of those. You know, with the high profile sports, you know, a lot of the younger kids are a lot attracted to those sports. A lot more
that they can see on TV.
And, you know, I remember when I first started playing lawn bowls, I was only 14 in high school, and everyone used to say, it's an old man's sport. And I mean, as time went on, the average age of the Australian lawn bowl side was about 24.
Professionally?
Yeah, professionally. And it's probably younger now. So, you know, but yeah, I think just the demographics, people move different areas and, you know, they get away from different things and have a different mindset. So yeah, it's probably difficult to put your finger on, but there's certainly a downturn in certain sports over others. And I'm not quite sure what the answer is to that and you know, why it's happened or how it happens, but.
Get kids outside.
Yeah, get them off the computers, mate. Get them outside in the sun and kicking a ball around or doing something like that. That's for sure.
Although, I got to say, the new Zelda game's coming out. That's the only game that I've actually been into. It's a long story, but my wife and I are into that one particular game. We are very excited about that one.
Well, mate, you've got me lost straight away because I know nothing about them, and I certainly like to spend all my time outside, whether it be winter or summer. It doesn't matter to me.
That's it. So, okay, what are some of the other ways that the turf industry has changed in the last few decades, do you reckon?
Oh, we touched on this earlier. The advancement of machinery, just the way that simple little things like how we adjust them to make them work better. You know, there used to be a huge process with the old bowling green mowers once upon a time that was difficult. Now it's a couple of adjustments on one particular area and it's done. You know, the types of machinery, the mechanisms that they use, that's just one example I can quote. And I mentioned a few things before about fertilizing and chemical techniques, just the way we go about that process, what's available to us. That sort of stuff is, it's all groundbreaking and it's evolving like WHS. So there's always something there that is a little better than it was before. So I think another big trend that I'm seeing a lot more frequently, or more recently, I should say, in our industry, is the use of microbes in soil. Once upon a time, you'd rely on them just being there in the soil profile naturally, but the listeners probably aren't aware that our sports turf soil profiles are basically made and imported. They're not natural blends. So we're looking at, you know, when we do our texture tests in our soil, we're looking for something between 70% sand, 30% silt clay. So they're quite sandy. Golf courses are about 90 sand, 10 soil. So what that means is that they don't hold moisture real well and they don't hold nutrition real well either. So the advancement in those sorts of things where we're able to use microbes, we can brew our own microbes and get them into the soil. So they do that job for us. Mm-hmm. They'll increase the way that the nutrition works. They'll increase the way the soil chemistry helps with the breakdown of mat and thatch and the microorganism activity in the soil, all that sort of thing. That's one of the real big things that it is. A lot of guys are trialing different things at the moment, different types of microbes. So you're able to actually add, I suppose it's like putting a multivitamin into your body. We're trying to do that with microbes in the soil to make the soil healthier.
Maybe it's a bit more like a probiotic.
Well, probably, yeah.
But yeah, it's like nature has these systems, and instead of trying to work against them like we used to, we're actually trying to harness nature, cultivate her, direct her in the directions that we want her to go in.
Yeah, and she'll help us out, hopefully, if we look after her.
Mm-hmm. And that's the key, is you've got to look after her as well.
For sure.
It's not just a one-way thing.
For sure.
So what are some of the most common misconceptions or myths around sports and turf management careers?
Everybody thinks we're millionaires, and I'm here to tell you we're not. we're certainly not. we talked a little bit about this a bit earlier. Just the amount of training and the detail that we have to go to make our areas do what we need them to do. Most people don't think there's that much work involved until they actually see the process. And, you know, you talk to the club members on a day-to-day basis sometimes, and they'll just say, how come you top dressed yesterday? Why didn't you do it? Oh, because I need to do this, or I needed to do that, or we've got this coming up, or the weather's not in our favour. And they might have a different opinion or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so there's always a misconception about why we do things. I mean, I used to have an old president who wanted to rewrite my entire yearly program because he thought it was going to work better. And it's like, all right, you know, so there's those things as well. The general public, first of all, we're up a little bit, I mean, the mass people as well. So we get most of our work done before everybody's out of bed. The most important parts of the job. So most of the public miss all that, the detailed stuff that we do early.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. It's we definitely need, and this is across all of horticulture, we need higher wages and we need more recognition for our skill set.
100%.
I don't know,
mate.
Why. I just see this perception that carpenters and stuff are more qualified than us. And it's brilliant what they do. They are very skilled technicians. And so are we, though.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, we do a four-year apprenticeship just like the Sparkies and the plumbers and you know, the builders. I don't know. And, mate, our industry was a glamour-type industry once upon a time. It was so difficult to get an apprenticeship because everybody wanted to do it. And, you know, there's a lot more money in the building industry, I guess, is maybe one reason why they get paid a little better and we're sort of left behind. And it's just always been that way, I think. And it's a shame because it's one of the big factors as to why we lose quite a few people post-trade is because, first of all, the opportunities may not be there for them to grab hold of after their apprenticeship is over. And, yeah, the money is just not quite there like it is in other trades, which is disappointing because it's really technical, it's really practical, and the outcomes that you can get far outweigh the bad things, you know. So, yeah, definitely I agree with you. We should be well paid, better paid than we are, and better recognized, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think we'll see a lot of automation in different industries. And I think that once automation comes into sports turf in terms of just the mowing, we're going to realize just how much more there is to it that cannot be automated, that really only a human being with the right knowledge and skill set, experience and education can actually get this done.
Sure. I mean, you've probably heard these sorts of comments before, and there's always been guys in a particular field that have been recognized as being legends, you know, and that just doesn't come because they're highly skilled. It comes because they have attention to detail. They can focus on certain things when they need to, and they can read things really well. Like they can read what the grass or the plant's telling them. They don't need to be looking at a manual or a plant schedule to tell them what's going on. They're able to recognize these things in advance and just do what's required. I mean, we used to have some other fellas that we used to refer to as God because they were just able to grow grass. they didn't need any, you know, special fertilizers or this. They just knew exactly what was required. Right. So, and they're in every industry, you know.
Yep.
So,
and this is why we have this podcast too, is that so that we get to accumulate some of that knowledge and get it down on the internet before, you know, people go off and do their other things. And because it's a shame, some of the people who are best at the job, no one ever hears them, or not enough people hear them. And yeah, I think it's really important that we share that. And that's why I applaud you as well for teaching at TAFE. This is an incredibly important role that more people need to step up and do because we're low on TAFE teachers, right?
Yeah, we sure are. Yeah. We lost quite a few during the COVID sort of period, and some of the technical requirements have been lifted for us as well. So there was a few staff that had been in the industry for a long time that didn't go back through and do those upgrades, and they'd just been there long enough and thought that it was time for a change. And yeah, we lost quite a few teachers. So and it's across all disciplines. It's not just in the horticultural space. There's quite a few missing.
Shame.
It is. Because it's always nice to give back. You know, as I said before, like the industry and the trade's given me everything I have. And it's really nice to give back because I've been involved in various associations and on various committees over the last three decades. And it's given me a lot of insight. I've made a lot of friends, lifelong friends, you know, that I still talk with today. And that stuff you can't buy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we urge anybody who's in the stage of their career where you've already done it all, you've seen it all, and you're looking for the next step, maybe it's teaching. Like maybe you need to reassess your life and think, okay, well, what legacy do I want to leave behind?
Yeah. I mean, it gives you a chance to actually impart your knowledge and everything that you've gained over however many years. And it may not be exactly what someone else has done, or, you know, your process might be a little different to someone else's, but the outcome you would hope is always the same. And it's all about, in our industry, there's no such thing as secrets, mate. No industry or trade secrets. Right. We've got trade shows and conferences that we get to each year, and you're always networking and talking to different greenkeepers or turf managers or whatever. And there's no secrets, mate. Everybody's happy to share information, and there might be something that they've tried and a new technique or a mixture of certain techniques that they've done that have got a successful result. All the turf managers and I'll be happy to share that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the sky's the limit, you know.
Yeah, totally. I think that's such a part of horticulture in general, is that we just have these industry giants, these experts, these people who've been there forever, who are just so generous with their time. They're at the trade shows. I can't even tell you how many times I've just been at a trade show and asked someone a question or something like that, just thinking like, oh, this is a little bit embarrassing. Maybe I should already know this. But they're so generous with their time and just so non-judgmental too, I think. What is it with plant people that we're like that?
Look, I don't know. I guess it's just because most of us are quite passionate about what we do. And you mentioned that, you know, you can walk up to somebody at a trade show or a conference or something. I mean, I've had it when I've been at a club playing bowls, and you get members walk up to you and ask you questions about, oh, I've got this wrong with my grass, or I've got this going on. And if you're more than happy to sit there and have a chat to them about what it could be and how they can go about fixing it. And there's never been an issue. You certainly don't sit there and go, mate, I've had enough today, I just want to go. Yeah, I'm more than happy to sit there and talk shop like that. So
you actually want people to ask you because you've spent so long thinking about it. Sometimes it's just good to actually have a chat about all this stuff you've been thinking about for so long.
Sure, yeah. And it could just be a simple thing that these people have no idea about. And it could be a simple fix. It could be a 5-minute fix. Who knows? It could be a 5-week fix. But it could be just that they're not aware of the process, and one little tip may be all it takes for them to get an outcome. So that's it. So, as I said, mate, there's no secrets in the trade. It's all we're happy to share whatever we need to, and so everybody benefits.
I love it. All right, so we've already kind of touched on career pathways, but I just wanted to just ask you one more time, like just before we close off the episode, like imagine there's someone listening to this right now who maybe they're in high school, maybe they're in accounting or something, they're just in a different industry, and they're just like, you know what, today's the day when I start planning for my career in turf. What do they need? Like, can you give us what's the next step that they need to take?
So if they're school leavers, young adults like that, first step would be trying to gain an apprenticeship in whatever discipline that you would like to follow in turf. And as we mentioned before, there's quite a few avenues that you can go down. There's some short courses that you can do at TAFE if you want an introduction. Maybe that might be something that they're interested in, and it might steer them down to the road of a Cert 3 in turf. But that's definitely the way where I would probably start to look. Go down to the local, like what I did when I was 16, I was on my push bike. I had a resume typed out, then I had my neighbor type for me because I didn't have a typewriter back then. And I rode around on my push bike to all the bowling clubs and handed my resume to the greenkeeper at the club to try and get an apprenticeship. So then when I was able to start driving, I would drive around looking for an apprenticeship at all the clubs that were out of area. So there's plenty of avenues to go down. Have a chat with your careers advisor, find out what steps you might need to take to get into the industry. But I would start by going down the road of approaching the local club, the local sporting facility, whatever it may be, and to see if there's a position available.
Absolutely. And I'd even say that there's an even easier way is to head on over to the website that I built, hortpeople.com. It's an industry job board for our industry. So plenty of turf jobs on there. GLG, I know, are hiring apprentices. There are a few other companies on the job board too, but GLG is a sponsor, so I better give them a special plug. And they're everywhere. So especially if you're in a capital city, just have a look on the job board. There's probably an apprenticeship job near you. And even if there's not one, contact GLG. You'll probably get a good job there. Completely free for job seekers, by the way.
Excellent. Even more attractive.
There we go. Yeah. So no excuses. You don't even have to get on your push bike with your handwritten resumes these days. Just click a link in the show notes and browse.
There you go. Browse to your heart's content. And there could be something there for you.
There's no excuses.
Not really. I mean, and you know, if you're interested in a particular discipline, I mean, you go to, you enroll at TAFE, you get an apprenticeship, you come and study hard, you do what's required, and you become qualified at the end of your 4-year tenure, and the sky is, you know, the world is your oyster.
Just before I ask you the final question, can you discuss the nuances between, you know, getting the apprenticeship or studying or under your own weight part-time and working during the day? Like, what's the difference there? Who, like, why would someone choose one and not the other?
I guess with an apprenticeship, because there's the training plans are developed through, you know, government type agencies, it's in your benefit to probably to go down that path. First of all, what it's going to do for you is it gives you a certain scope of training at TAFE, and you're not there 5 days a week out of the 7, right? If you're on the job, you're learning practical experience as well as the technical side of things from TAFE. So you get to work with both sides in that one setting in that 4-year period. So we've had students that have come in that are unemployed in the industry, let's say, for example, and they've done horticulture before, or they've done the Cert II agriculture course and they were interested in turf. So they've come in to do sports turf. Because they're not actually working in the industry, it's quite difficult to make that crossover because you don't have that hands-on practical experience from in your workplace.
Yeah, it's not the same thing as hedging and pruning. No, and all that. It's completely different. And if you've done lawn mowing before, that's not what we're talking about here.
No, that's right. So, you know, it just makes a lot more sense. And I'll tell you, it's a lot easier for us to organise session plans and practical days around the guys' training when we know that they're getting a full practical outcome at work and they're able to mix the two together. Right. So, and like we do block release at our campus. So they're at TAFE on a Tuesday, Wednesday, and a Thursday for 1 week a month. And then they're at work for the rest of that month. We've got a couple of school-based apprentices that are in as well. So they're working at particular golf courses or bowling clubs 1 day a week and then go back to school. And then when the TAFE blocks are on, they come in and see us for the 3 days. So there's another avenue that the guys can chase up if they want to sit through their HSC or continue schooling and not have a full-time job. They're still active in the industry and they're enrolled at TAFE at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So, look, we take a hit on the pay rate, on the hourly pay rate when we have an apprenticeship, but then we don't have to pay for the course. So you have to balance that out.
Yeah, correct.
And that's a pain in the butt to pay that off, mate.
Well, it was too long ago for me to think about. So, I hear what you're saying, and I hear, you know, the guys talk about it on campus quite a bit. You know, there's some guys that have done 2 and 3 extra courses before coming to TURF, so they know what it costs them to do that. And then when they get it now, that a lot of the courses are free, provided they have the opportunity to be employed as well. You know, they're winning, right? It's a win-win.
Absolutely. All right, so we've come to the end of the episode now, Dave.
Excellent.
Always one final question I like to ask guests. It doesn't have to be on topic. It can be about anything you like, whether that's you want to advocate for a change in the world, whether you want to plug something, whether you want to talk about what you did on the weekend. This is your free time. Is there anything else you'd like us to know about?
All right. Well, I'll leave you with one little fun fact then. So, and it's turf related, shock horror, right? So,
it's your prerogative.
Yeah. Sports turf arenas and facilities comprise the most observed turf in the world. So think about TV, all the major sporting events and things like that. And so all of this turf is observed by millions of people worldwide. So when you think about sports turf, you think about what you've seen on TV and recognize that it's probably the most watched turf in the world. Sports turf is. So And we all know what how the venues look on TV. We've seen, most of us have seen golf tournaments before, or watched football or soccer or cricket or AFL for that matter. We all know what the venues and the arenas look like. And that's because of people like us that are passionate about what we do and make things the way they are. So players are safe. The spectators get an outcome. They're able to follow their particular sporting team, however well they might go. I mean, my team, Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs, are doing terribly, but I'll still follow them. So just keep that in mind. Every time we watch the TV, there's always someone like me that's there, that's been there working endlessly and tirelessly to make sure that it looks as good as it does. And there's an outcome there for everybody, something there for everybody to look at.
Yeah, there's so often, like, the only time when we ever get feedback is when we do something wrong. And when you're working at that level, it's not going to happen that often, so you're not getting that much feedback.
Well, if you think about it, it's quite everything's visual. All your results mm-hmm. are visual. So you're right. If you make a mistake, that's the first thing people see. Mm. What happened there? What happened here? And over the years, there's been vandalism occur and different things, and it's the first thing people see, right? They don't always compliment you on how good everything looks. It's just like, wow, what happened there?
Yeah, I guess this is what you have to live with when you're in turf, because if you get no complaints, that's a good thing, because it just means that it just looks normal, which is perfection.
Well, I have a saying, and I sort of transfer this over to the students when they come in. Great grass is no accident, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot
Ain't
to
that
it.
The truth?
Yeah, it sure
Ain't
is,
that
right?
The truth. Yeah, totally. What a beautiful note to end it on, Dave.
Great grass is no accident.
Absolutely. Great grass is no accident. Mate, thank you so much for a great chat. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed it too.
Shout out to TAFE New South Wales, who are a silver sponsor of the Australian Institute of Horticulture, an organisation that I volunteer for on the National Council. Sure, you can get a job in sports turf management and learn a whole lot of valuable stuff on the tools, but you're unlikely to really grasp some of the inner mechanics of the art and science unless you studied the subject formally. Check the show notes for a link to TAFE New South Wales course curriculum, or Google Study Sports Turf and browse the options near you. If you're interested in a sports turf career, head on over to hortpeople.com and upload your resume. Tick the turf job category as well as any others that tickle your fancy.